Welcome back to Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. I am so excited about the show that we have ahead of us. We have some phenomenal information that could save lives. You're going to need to tune in to what's going on today. The information is jam-packed, so don't step away. Hello, thank you so much for joining Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. I am your host, Dr. Michael Karlfeldt. I've been in clinical practice since 1987. I've seen pretty much everything under the sun. I worked with so many different Lyme patients, and I know what a devastating disease this is. That's why I'm doing this podcast, to make sure that you are armed with the information that you need in order to be able to be successful in your struggle with Lyme. We'll be featuring authors, doctors, professors, and also people like yourself that have gone through the journey that you're going through, that have been where you've been and is now on the other side, and they get to tell their victorious story as to how they battle Lyme so that you can implement that in your life as well. Be sure to like us and write a review on whichever platform that you're listening on. What that does is it enables other people to see us more so that they have access to this information as well. So I'm so excited that you're tuning in, and get ready for this upcoming show. It is going to be amazing. Well, today I have the honor to have Dr. Jamie Kunkel here with me. He is somebody that specialized in Lyme and very kind of complex diseases. Thank you so much for being with me here today. I appreciate this.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to our discussion.
So tell me a little bit, and I usually start with this for, with other providers. Either you battle Lyme or you have... it's something that you really feel passionate about, and you've seen the impact on people's lives, and you want to unravel that. And what drove you in the direction, where you're at?
Well, sure. I mean, it's a really good question. I come from the state of Pennsylvania, which is, land of Lyme. I think it has like some of the highest rates of any state. I've also lived in, the Northeast and seen Vermont and, the New England region and all that kind of thing. So I grew up around Lyme. So I was kind of aware of it. I was aware, I guess, superficially at a young age of some of the controversies around it, because I remember people saying, I have Lyme, and then people kind of reacting in a certain way, because there was always this perception, you get a tick and then you treat it and then all that kind of thing. But I remember people around me actually, kind of suffering from what they call Lyme early in my life. And I didn't really think, I guess, too much of it, because I was fortunate not to manifest any illness at that time in my life. And then I went to naturopathic school and kind of, learned that whole thing. And I think, it was really good foundation for entering into any complex illness field, just in terms of how thorough we are in understanding how the different parts of the body connect, and, getting to the source, getting to the root of those issues, and just really listening to the patient, really working with them sort of as a team. And so I think I kind of came out with a little bit of predisposition to finding Lyme, I guess. And then, as they always say, that the patients find you, and I think they ultimately did. But I did end up joining a practice that was specialized more in complex illnesses, and Lyme was one of them. And I sort of started working with it early on in my career. And I just kind of from there. And incidentally, my family ended up getting affected by it. And as I became more aware of it, I started picking up those signs. So my daughter had Babesia and Lyme, and we treated that, and my wife has suffered from it as well. I've treated my mother-in-law, now my uncle, and my father. All of them have had Lyme now. It's crazy, because once you know something, you can find the early signs and treat it early. And if you treat it early, it's more like a straightforward infection, which is really the best time to treat it. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background. So it has hit me, personally, for sure. But it's something I'm really passionate about now, and really want to try to help people, find their path to healing.
Yeah. And I guess if you're on the East Coast and the land of Lyme, it's just a matter of time. And that's the thing, exactly. If you're aware of the symptoms, aware of the signs, and recognizing that the prevalence of it, that it's not something that is very rare. It is more common than we think. And if we address it early, then we're at a much better spot.
Absolutely. And that's really ideal. And most of what we'll probably be talking about today, to be clear, is probably when it either doesn't get treated early or it doesn't get treated effectively early, and some of the fallout that happens from that. And that's where things get a lot more complicated. So, yeah.
And Lyme, I mean, obviously it's something that would fall under, you know, the complex disorders, you know, that because it is very complex. Yeah. I mean, give me a little feeling. I mean, why in your mind is it considered complex?
Well, and I am referring to the chronic Lyme manifestation generally. I mean, because I think it can be complicated in the acute form, but as I said, it's sometimes a little more obvious once you kind of know the signs and, you know, you might be able to test it and treat it. But in the complex form, it's multisystemic. There's more than one body system that's involved. It may manifest differently for each person, depending on their individual constitution, their genetics, their, you know, co-conditions, what else they have, other adversities in their life, and even their strengths, you know, in their constitution. You know, they may not have as many issues with cognitive things, but they may have, you know, maybe more body connective tissue, arthritis type symptoms or something like that. So it becomes complicated mostly because, one, there isn't necessarily a straightforward of an answer. I mean, it may be in some cases, if you catch it early enough, that it just wasn't recognized and just needs to be treated straightforward. And that may be the case, but sometimes it gets a little more, in order to be successful, at least in my practice with mostly complex chronic illness and very sensitive patients, mind you, it becomes really integral to understand what body systems also need to be supported at the same time. It may be the endocrine or hormone system in some people. It may be that they are terribly depleted in nutrition. They may have an overload or overburden of toxins in their system. There's just thousands of things it could be. So you have to be able to really parcel that out and differentiate it to see success. As I said, my bias being I treat most of the folks that don't have straightforward answers to, but I consider generally any chronic manifestations in Lyme probably falling a little bit more under the complex illness umbrella.
And one of the challenges, I mean, obviously can manifest in so many different ways, but the neurological kind of the brain, you know, once that start to can be impacted, it really is debilitating and really takes a person down. I mean, you have patients that essentially lay in bed for like 6 months straight, you know, because they are so exhausted. I mean, just being able to take a shower, that's like a feat they can't do every day. And then, you know, people that they are in a gas station in a small town that they've lived in since they grew up, and then all of a sudden they don't know how to get home. You know? So, yeah. There's a lot of different aspects of the neurological Lyme. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about that and, you know, how is that different than, you know, some of the physical manifestations like joint or, you know, muscle pain or so forth?
Sure. I mean, it's an important conversation because it is some of the most debilitating, and not to say that chronic pain and arthritis is not debilitating. I mean, it certainly can be, especially if it's on like the rheumatic arthritis type level, but these neurologic manifestations are a lot more difficult. I mean, most of the time they're considered by conventional medicine, these sort of subjective features sometimes, and they're kind of hard to really quantify or really, you know, you can measure them in terms of physical examination and some maybe labs or whatever, but a lot of times they're sort of seen as really very subjective. Like I have brain fog, I have memory problems, I'm depressed, I'm very, very fatigued. Well, it's like, well, you look fine, so how can that be? And that kind of thing. And so, one of the biggest challenges, I think, really is recognition that this is from something like Lyme, first of all, and then how it manifests in different parts of the nervous system can be incredibly debilitating. So I usually think of two parts of the nervous system here generally. I guess you could say three if you really want to break it down. But like we have our central nervous system symptoms, we have our peripheral nervous system symptoms, might be neuropathies and things like that. And then we have like our autonomic nervous system symptoms. Yeah. And that's sort of our unconscious regulatory systems of our body. So normally we don't really have to think about them too much. Like we're standing up and moving around and everything's nice and fluid and cool. And I'm talking and everything's going great. But whenever those unconscious regulatory systems break down, it can be incredibly debilitating. So you may see like, yeah, pots dysautonomia type stuff, for example, like orthostatic intolerance. You feel like you're passing out, get up, So yeah, it can manifest in a number of different ways. And the central nervous system stuff, I'll go into more detail with it, but like, yeah, the brain fog, the cognitive issues, the headaches, or, you know, migraine type reactions, neuritises and different things, cranial nerve neuropathies. I mean, there's a lot that can kind of come from that. And people can have pretty scary, very intensive symptoms when it's in, you know, that particular area, meningeal irritation, you know, encephalopathies of various kinds. So it can get a little hairy sometimes up there, versus, you know, maybe a peripheral neuropathy is really unsettling too, numbness or, you know, pain responses or different things. But yeah, the stuff up here, I think, is where things become, you know, the most challenging for people usually.
Yeah. And I mean, and the challenge is obviously as you're in this situation and you try to figure out a solution, and then, you know, the faculty that you're needing to figure out a solution is just not online. It's not available.
That's right. And
yeah, that makes it even more frustrating as you're trying to navigate this.
Hello, dear listeners. This is Dr. Michael Karlfeldt, your host of Integrative Lyme Solutions. Today, I'm excited to share an exclusive opportunity from the Karlfeldt Center, where we blend healing power of nature with groundbreaking therapies to combat Lyme disease and its associated challenges. At the Karlfeldt Center, we're not just fighting Lyme, we're revolutionizing the way it's treated with cutting-edge therapies like photodynamic therapy, full-body ozone IV therapy, silver IVs, brain rebalancing, autonomic response testing, laser energetic detoxification, and more. We aim to eradicate Lyme. Our approach is comprehensive, supporting your body's immune system, detoxification processes, hormonal balance, and mitochondrial health, ensuring a holistic path to recovery. Understanding Lyme disease and its impact is complex, which is why we're offering a free 15-minute discovery call with one of our Lyme-literate naturopathic doctors. This call is your first step towards understanding how we can personalize your healing journey, focusing on you as a whole person, not just your symptoms. Our team, led by myself, Dr. Michael Karlfeldt, is here to guide you through your recovery with the most advanced diagnostic tools, individualized treatment plans, and supportive therapies designed to restore your health and vitality. Whether you're facing Lyme disease head-on or seeking preventative strategies, we're committed to your wellness. Take the first step towards reclaiming your health. Visit us at thekarlfeldtcenter.com or call us at 208-338-8902 to schedule your free discovery call. At the Karlfeldt Center, we believe in healing naturally, effectively, and holistically. Thank you for tuning in into Integrative Lyme Solution with Dr. Karlfeldt. Remember, true health is not just the absence of disease, it's achieving the abundance of vitality. Let's discover yours together.
For the neurological, are there certain co-infections or infections that tend to play more of a role when that starts to manifest?
Yeah. And that's important to understand too, is that when we say Lyme, we could mean a lot of things. Because if we're just referring to Borrelia burgdorferi, the spirochete, I mean, it does enough to allow for other infections, whether they be co-infections in terms of they've maybe entered from similar vectors or other vectors even in the system, or even just opportunistic infections, things that we harbor regularly that normally we handle really well. For like an example is like Epstein-Barr virus, the herpes viruses, you know, all those types of guys, Mycoplasma pneumoniae, you know, those types of guys too, that can cause a pretty immense amount of fatigue and neurologic symptoms in some people. And then co-infections with neurologic Lyme, if you want to call it that, Bartonella is a big one, of course. And that some people don't think that that's really most often from a tick, for example. So it's like it may just be something else in our environment. It's zoonotic, maybe from our animals or something like that, maybe from another type of insect bite. So there's so many vectors for these things. And Babesia is not much different. It's a parasite, not a bacteria in this case. And it can cause a lot of encephalopathy issues, a lot of autonomic regulation issues. It It's funny, for a long time, it's like we'd say, oh, this is all Lyme Borrelia. And then people would be like, no, what we thought was Lyme Borrelia was Bartonella. And then now we're kind of going first full circle and we're like coming out further. We're like, now it's probably Babesia because we've, tried these things. So it's quite interesting. But all of them, it's the three Bs, most often the big players that are running that show. And then you have these smaller players that are still important, mind you, like in a flare state. It may be that that person's cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr virus is replicating and flaring through the roof, and those things are proximal and in the nervous system and in the endothelium, the blood systems. It's like, yeah, that's where it gets really complicated. And so you really want to understand what the infection landscape is in these individuals, because when they have Lyme Borrelia or whatever in there, it's you. They have other features too, and you really have to know if you're going to take a kill model, for example. I'm going to put an antimicrobial in here. You really want to know what you're treating. So, try your best anyway. There's pattern differentiation. There's better testing now than there used to be. Not perfect, but we're getting there.
Yeah, and that was always a challenge, obviously, in regards to testing and being able to identify these things that, in themselves suppress the immune system. And when you're measuring immune system response to, look to see if they're there, and
That's right.
they themselves suppress immune system, then obviously we're not going to get a good response. And it was interesting you were talking about, so obviously we have the ticks. And that's what we kind of think about in regards to Lyme, but there are other agents, like Borrelia. I'm sorry, Bartonella, another name for it's cat scratch fever. And then Babesia, very similar to kind of like the malaria bug. And then so you have kind of cross where it's not just a tick. There's so many other possibilities. So, that's why frequently, people that have Lyme may never seen like a bullseye rash or may not ever even been bitten by a tick.
Right, that's totally correct. You can have a Lyme syndrome without a clear tick bite, without a clear bullseye. And then, there's a small percentage of tick bites that even have or manifest as bullseyes or EM rashes, erythema migrans. So yeah, there's so many other vectors. That's why people are trying to, call this more of a vector-borne illness rather than a tick-borne illness. But ticks are certainly, I think one physician once said they're like nature's dirty needle. So I mean, it is really like it's pretty bad sometimes to get that many infections at once with some of the immune suppressive elements of a tick too, that the tick has ways in which it sort of promotes the integration of these infections into the body. So it is a particularly bad vector to have exposure, I have to say. But these folks could have other exposures from other vectors, and maybe they have other susceptibilities, and sometimes you have to dive a little deeper into that. Is that genetics? Is that, mold or mycotoxin illness or something like that? Or is like, what else is suppressing the immune system? So they're not getting the tick suppression effect, but they might be getting the environment suppression effect, or the constitutional in some case if they have immune deficiency disorders.
And all of it is like a bucket effect, meaning
Yeah.
that they all add onto each other. So
Yes.
if you have environmental stressors that will make it harder for you to battle than any kind of tick-borne, disease. You're talking about kind of understanding the landscape, of, what kind of infectious agents are we dealing with, talking about tests, that they're better now than,
Some of
West, yeah, well, some of them, than the Western blot that we thought was the gold standard. So tell me a little bit, how do you go about finding out, what the landscape looks like? Because obviously, like you mentioned, if you're going to bring in antimicrobial, you want to be very specific, very targeted, and then you need to understand what you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so some of the new testing I've been excited about is using different strategies than what we've done before. So like you said, traditional antibody testing, aka serology, has been the gold standard, and still to this day, guidelines need updated, but the CDC is still saying you got to do basically antibody origin testing. And it's interesting when you get to the nervous system too, because of course they'll be like, okay, so do those antibody tests, and maybe occasionally for acute neurologic manifestations in Lyme, we'll do a CSF or a cerebral spinal fluid or a lumbar puncture or something crazy invasive, but they don't do much else. So where there's two tiers of testing though, generally there's those indirect tests, which are relying on the body's response. And they may be better in the beginning of an illness when the immune system is otherwise functioning normally or was functioning normally prior to the introduction of this character. But those tests become less reliable as we go on. So if you're 5 years out now from that original exposure and you're still sick, those tests become less useful generally. Then we have other forms of indirect testing that I've used before too that are still helpful. And I think in some cases they are better than serology, like lymphocyte response testing, ELISpot technology, things of this nature. If the T cells, if the innate immune system, this other part of your immune system is working functionally otherwise, you can use that those tests to see what is currently trying to deal with itself, and you can support the body now, you know, through that process in one way or another. And that may be your therapeutic target right now. The T cells are lit up for Bartonella, so maybe we should be supporting the system for Bartonella right now. So those can help us differentiate where our target may need to be at that particular juncture and moment in time, and then that may change over the course of treatment, and we can use that as an objective marker. And then you have the direct testing. And what we've been using most recently, and it may be the flavor of the week, I admit, but you know, where I've liked is the RNA tests. Basically, it's based off the FISH technology, the fluorescence in situ hybridization, but it's kind of taken it a little bit further. So that's the T Labs testing. And what that does is it shows us actual images, incidentally, of blood sampling and the presence of RNA. From those bugs in that particular sample. And it's harder to deny that. It's like, there's RNA. It's like, well, but is it alive or dead? It's like, well, RNA doesn't stay around in the system quite as long as DNA does. So if you're like, hey, there's a DNA test, PCR, whatever, like, well, I don't know if that's alive or dead. You know, those old urine tests we have, it's like, clearly you've had Lyme exposure, but I don't know if it's still in there. Mm-hmm. So these RNA tests have been really exciting. They also made a culture enhanced PCRs and stuff that they've been using too. It's interesting to me because stuff like Lyme Borrelia doesn't live in the blood, but because if the amount of replication, the load in the system is high enough, there are going to be fragments that enter into the bloodstream still. And so that's one way that the body has to constantly sort of get rid of, you know, cellular waste. And that's one of the theories, incidentally, of long COVID, that persistent RNA, persistent spike protein may be one of the causes of persistent inflammation. They're not even alive anymore. And people are starting to study that in Lyme now, too, incidentally. So, yeah, so I've been excited about the blood testing in that way. I think as of late is that if I can take the immune system out of the equation altogether, all that complexity, all that possible chaos that's been formed there, especially the more chronic that person is, really see that objectivity right there. And we've all wanted to have a culture for all these years, you know, to really prove that there's a, you know, something, and the culture is kind of there. And I don't think it's as good as the RNA, but so the best I have right now is that. And then I could be like, okay, there it is. It's in there, and it must have been active recently because there's a lot of it in there, you know, that kind of thing. And we got it in a random sample. So let's go after it, you know. And it has to, of course, match the clinical picture, the signs and symptoms. And I have to do intensive immunology testing, which I can get into later. But it's a good superficial structure that I have right now. Yeah.
So how, I mean, here we're talking about the RNA then, and you know, maybe the infection itself is gone, but you have the RNA still.
Yeah.
And that causes the immunosuppression, and that make you symptomatic. How do you clear, I mean, is there a strategy to clear out that RNA then?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of COVID, for example, it's an interesting concept. And I think it's been studied, that model has been studied the most so far in COVID, largely based off of, well, some of it's based off the work of Dr. Bruce Patterson. And then there's been other researchers that have also looked at this from different lenses. And so it seems like on the one hand, there is a deficit in clearance from the system. And in the case of Patterson's work, it's monocytes. It's a certain immune cell that's not functioning correctly. They're normally the guys that do clean up. You know, they're the guys that do recalibrate after a tumultuous event, like even an acute tick bite. And so they may be a therapeutic target. And he's, you know, tried to focus on them through different drug treatment avenues, some of which are cool and some of which can have side effects, I think. There's the concept of autophagy and sort of removing damaged cellular debris and cellular systems that aren't, you know, working or functioning properly. And I think that that's an interesting area to look at. There's a lot of ways to induce autophagy or support it in the system. There's stuff like as easy as intermittent fasting. And then there's, you know, stuff like rapamycin or, you know, certain things used in the anti-aging world. There's antioxidants and certain flavonoids that can help it. Yeah, and so stuff like that may be interesting. And then also, I think if you there's a lot of very basic foundational detox strategies too for, you know, for just clearing things out of one system. And I think that it does start with making sure the organs of elimination are working, you know, like your gut system is working well, you're keeping well hydrated, you know, you're supporting your kidney function, sweating and all these types of things. And so, like, you know, we've seen more, we used to provoke tests for DNA and stuff like that by making somebody exercise, sweat, and move around a whole bunch. And so, like, when you do that, you actually mobilize a lot of these materials out into the system. So some people can get really inflamed when they get a massage or when they, you know, do something, you know, physically, mechanically moving. And that's like lymphatic work might be useful for that reason too. There's just so many things you can do from like a body work and physical perspective. But I really try to integrate those things into the system, into the treatment process with people. And there's so many different ways, you know, types of body work, but you know, the ones that work are the best ones all the time, of course.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people sometimes don't recognize, you made a comment earlier as well, that Borrelia, you know, and Bartonella, they really don't, they're not floating around in the bloodstream. Yeah. You know, so it's not like you can kind of, you know, capture it in the bloodstream. They tend to be in, you know, where do they tend to be? I mean, where, so well, people understand kind of how they move about. And sure. I mean, if they don't move through the bloodstream, how do they move about, and where are they? I mean, where do they tend to hang out?
Well, to be clear, Bartonella and Babesia are more well known to live in the blood. Like they can actually live inside of red blood cells in the endothelium or the wall of the vessels too. And so those guys are more known to hang out there. Borrelia, on the other hand, doesn't really like highly vascularized space. It doesn't really like those spaces. It's going to be more likely to go to a joint or connective tissue type place arrangement with less blood flow. That's why it tends to preference the joints as far as that goes, or it's going to hide somewhere. People used to say it likes to go to vulnerable areas of the body for that reason, areas of old injury. A lot of people have more symptoms around areas of old injury. It seems like they like to kind of hide in these little, you know, little caves, so to speak. But also the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi is a swimmer. It has a little tail and everything, and it swims really freaking fast. So if it wants to get into the blood briefly, it'll travel somewhere, but it'll travel somewhere extremely quickly. And sometimes the immune system will even be trying to tail it, and it's like a high speed chase, basically, like an action movie or something. It's crazy. So I know that's actually been recorded, weirdly enough. I'm not making that up, but it's true. So, like, you know, the only way you're gonna catch it sometimes is if you get it to move, and sometimes that's if you're provoking it in some way, and that may be through provoking through movement, body work, and mechanical forces, or it may be provoking through treatment as well.
Yeah. And going back then to, you know, the brain, the neurological, I mean, so
yeah,
we know kind of how it can manifest, but what does the process look like in the brain? I mean, what's actually happening? Is it inflammation, excessive immune response? Are we dealing with, you know, less clearing of toxins, you know, because of kind of inflammation along the arteries or veins, or what is happening?
I would say a little bit of all the above in some cases. it could be any one of those things. That's the crazy part about it, is that when we think of, for example, neuro Lyme or neuro borreliosis, there's this classical thought pattern that goes to Lyme is in my brain, or, you know, Borrelia is in my brain, but it isn't really always the case. I mean, there's not an easy way to test that in a living person. You might be able to do cerebral spinal fluid, as I said, but there's not like a brain biopsy really, you know, like nobody does that. And the only time they've ever found evidence of it in the brain is more often in postmortem, you know, after death studies of people. So it is theoretically possible, but we don't always know that it's actually happening. So then we have to think, well, why are we seeing neurologic manifestations? So there could be peripheral elements, things outside the nervous system that are leading to nervous system dysregulation. So we have to think, you know, what is the nervous system's normal functioning strategy or dynamics to keep it working properly? So it has a blood-brain barrier, for example, that it's a privileged site. So it gets a certain number of things in and also releases a certain amount of waste material on a regular basis. Sort of different than other tissues in the body. It has a different metabolic process. It's very highly metabolically driven, which means it needs a lot of energy. It needs a lot of food source energy. It needs a lot of mitochondria to sort of take those food items or nutritional items and make energy. So there's a lot of things that can kind of go wrong within that process. So blood-brain barrier disruption has been one theory in a lot of these different illnesses, and it is possible those things can become leakier. It is tied in some ways to the gut too. So when the gut barrier starts to break and things start to get awry there, the brain starts to suffer too. And there's a lot of different connection points. Some of it's through the blood, some of it's through, you know, vagus nerve probably, or other connective, you know, points, the vagus nerve being your primary autonomic nerve. From the brain to the gut and other peripheral tissues. And so there's a lot of different systems that can break down. The blood is a big part of it, because obviously it carries oxygen and nutrients, as I mentioned, and, you know, being a high energy driven system, you need those basic things in order for the brain to work. And so if there's an infection in the blood, for example, or there's more cytokines or inflammatory signals, the blood gets sludgier and thicker too, and more fibrin sort of gets formed. It creates more of a barrier system. That diffusion of oxygen and nutrients kind of starts to break down. So that can be a problem. So there can be neurovascular issues that can lead to more fatigue, brain fog, depression, and different things. And those have been measured even by functional neurologic imaging in different cases. You may see like the SPECT scan, or you may see you know, even a neuroquant or a functional MRI or something, you'll see different changes in the brain structures and whatnot. And then, you know, you're going to get, if there is a sense that there is a danger happening in the nervous system, maybe the blood-brain barrier is leaky, more stuff's coming in, more stuff's also leaking out, by the way, like your neurotransmitters and things that are really important for your brain. So that's another reason why you can feel kind of, you know, crappy, because the containment of the good stuff is also not always functioning properly. But yeah, you can basically get different varieties of, you know, encephalopathy or whatever you want to call it, type responses from these blood dynamics too. And, you know, as I said, there's reactivation of infections that can happen that are in the nervous system more likely. That may be where your viruses can hit you a little bit harder. There can be more often than not with autoimmune manifestations, if we're talking about antibodies, a lot of them are actually formed peripherally. These are not actually like just magically formed in the brain, you know, like they get to the brain through the blood and through that blood-brain barrier disruption in most cases. And they may start in some other tissue somewhere. They may start in the blood or in the gut, like the microbiome in the gut. There's a lot of gut stuff all over this place, all over this thing. And so, you know, there's different ways that can happen. And then the microglia, which is your internal, you know, immune system in your brain, can become overactivated, and they can, you know, gene switch and do all kinds of weird things. The mast cell system, people have talked about that many times, can get upset. They're just another part of the innate immune system that can become activated, even by peripheral elements, but that will still affect the brain. I mean, I can go on and on. There's like 1,000 mechanisms of like how the brain could get influenced. And just on the detox front though, really quick, as I said, the brain has a normal circulatory flow where, you know, good stuff comes in and bad stuff comes out. And part of it is mediated through the lymphatic system and the cerebral spinal fluid system. And if these things aren't working right, that's when you get an accumulation of all kinds of junk up there. And that includes like amyloid and, you know, abnormal protein malformations and things that normally the immune system or the body would clear out. You know, now we have a lack of movement outward from that. And the buildup of quinones and stuff has been, you know, marked in Lyme in the brain. Those are pretty toxic. And sometimes, this is another thing, one more thing, and I'll let you know. One more thing is sometimes the structural system begins to break down. So even if it is attacking the connective tissue, if it's attacking the connective tissue of, say, the cervical spine or the neck, now you can get sometimes you can get something called craniocervical instability, and then that starts to affect everything. It's like the cranial nerves get influenced, 9, 10, 11, especially according to some theories. the blood flow in and the blood flow out, especially the outflow. And any outflow obstruction, jugular vein, all that disrupts the whole glymphatic, CSF, you know, detox, you know, thing. So you really got to understand, and there's even probably more than what I'm saying, because there always is, but you really got to understand the complexity of how the body is connected to the nervous system when you're evaluating these cases, because then you can really hone in like, oh, it's more of this issue in this person. This is where we really need to focus here. And if that person has like CCI, craniocervical instability, that's a structural issue. You got to get the inflammation down, but now you have to treat a structural issue. You see? So anyway, yeah, I could go on and on, but that's good.
I mean, yeah, here you're saying, yeah, there's a thousand different reasons. And we've just gone through like 15, 20.
Right.
So how do you, as a provider, you have a patient coming and they're having these issues, and there can be a thousand things going on up there.
Yes.
How do you navigate that? I mean, how do you, strategically address that and make sure that we're able to move to the other side?
Sure. I mean, it's a really good question, and it's something I'm always working on too. It's like the quicker I can kind of get from point A, which is I don't know entirely yet where I need to focus here, to point B, where I'm like, okay, I'm pretty sure this is where we need to be. Mm-hmm. It's even point C, where I'm like, we're rolling. It's good. Momentum of healing, everything's cool. So it's a tough process. I mean, for one, this is why, if any of you guys out there or my patients are going to be my patients, I spend a lot of time in the beginning with you, as most of us do. In the beginning, I mean, I'm hearing your story. It's like a 2-hour visit usually, and there's probably more visits after that. That may even just be a 2-hour talking visit. The ancient art of physical examination can be quite powerful too. And I don't see as much of that anymore. That's why I say it's, a little archaic now, apparently. But getting to actually know the person, get your hands on them can make a really big difference. I can see if they're struggling a lot with autonomic issues. I can see if they're having a lot of connective tissue disturbances, and they're more like, say, hypermobile on that spectrum, which can come with its own set of issues. I can see if they look, to be more mast cell driven, for example. I mean, there's just so many things I can do. I can just see how their eyes track, and how their, their movement, how fluid that is, and just, or not. It's just so many different aspects you can really see more in an in-person setting. So even though I do a lot of telehealth, I make sure that I see people, at least in the beginning, and then, probably yearly or as needed sort of thereafter. And so that makes a big difference. And then I do a lot of testing. That's true. And I'd like to not make people spend a lot of money on testing. But once again, the people that see me tend to have tried the normal things first. So just that's my bias. Not everybody needs to do like 5 tests, but in the cases of my patients, they're coming in asking really complicated questions. There are ways to use the testing to your advantage. And so some of those things are better than others, as they always are. And I'm thankful and fortunate that, some of my patients have sort of given us, in some ways, by accepting all those tests and doing them, they've given us more information and feedback for other patients to really try to hone in and be like, okay, well, those other 5 tests I used to use, I'm not using as much anymore now, but these other 5 I'm really happy about. Like I said, sometimes there's flavor of the week issues, but most of the time it's stuff that's been more tried and true and a little more respectable in terms of the clinical and translating it into clinical action as far as that goes. And then there is the other ancient art of trial and error, unfortunately, but I hate to say that, but unfortunately it's practice, it's medicine. That's how it goes. Like, we have our best guess, our understanding as we know it. And that understanding may change with how we treat, honestly. And I might just be like, oh yeah, this is definitely like a tick-borne Lyme Borrelia thing. Mm-hmm. And then as we start trying to treat it, maybe from a traditional lens, because maybe it hasn't been done before, you're not getting the response that you're expecting, mm-hmm. or maybe it's making them worse. And why is it making them worse? And so then it kind of asks more questions. So you have to be continually asking questions. You can't get too comfortable. You have to be okay with a little bit of self-critique, and even maybe the critique of your patient sometimes. Like, hey, doc, this isn't working. Like, that's cool. Let's figure it out. Okay, I'm sorry it's not working, but let's figure it out together. You and I. I'm not going to take it personally, So it is establishing a good rapport and relationship with the patient at the beginning, and it's you know, continuing to learn and expand your understanding and your paradigms, not getting too rigid in them. That's really what it comes down to at the end of the day. And when I can do all that effectively, I can really start to hone in. And so it's a process. I work with people on average, you know, 1 to 2 years for, you know, the easier level of the complex illnesses. And that's just, you know, kind of how it is, especially if they've been sick for more than 5 years already. You know, it's not going to go away in, you know, 3 months. Occasionally I hit a home run and it's like, yeah, I love it. But this is my patient population, though, to be clear.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is a complex disorder. And, yeah. And like you're saying, I mean, here you're dealing with 1,000 different factors, you know, so as a provider to be able to own in exactly, you know, to kind of find that needle in the haystack immediately, yeah, you know, that it's almost an impossibility. But I mean, obviously with experience and having seen lots of patients, we get better and better at it. Yes. But we at least we have a pattern of circling that needle and getting closer and closer as we are then refining the protocol. And each kind of step, even though it may not be bullseye, you know, it's still beneficial, even, you know, and it still has a functional reason, you know, for a lot of the different things that we do.
Yeah, oftentimes we're peeling layers too. So it's kind of cool. We may be like, okay, this area needs support. And then it actually does alleviate some of the symptoms and does, you know, give the person, boosts them up a little bit. And so, and then we may have to work on something, you know, else after that. But sometimes it is just sort of peeling layers and sort of moving up that mountain too, so to speak. So things change for that reason too. But, you know, with the exception of my very, well, I won't say they're too rare because I see a lot of very sensitive patients, but some of the patients that have been maybe labeled more mast cell activation or more environmentally sensitive, those folks may take a little longer sometimes to unwind. But what's really important is if you identify in the beginning that they do say have MCS, MCAS, whatever, you're identifying, you know, maybe where it's coming from, like where the sensitivity is coming from, then you can really, in those cases, you can try to work on toning that down and upfront. And those are some cases where, you know, symptomatic therapies can be really helpful and efficacious because now you're stopping some of the fire cycling, the inflammatory cycling, and you're leaving them open, hopefully, to treating some of the deeper causes and etiologic issues. So, you know, you have to be willing to step out of, you know, some of your comfort zone sometimes in that regard. You might be like, well, I'm not just going to band-aid this symptom or whatever, but it's like, okay, well, we band-aid at the right time and then we have to have a plan. Right. So we might be a need when it's appropriate, but we have to have a plan after that. We're not just going to leave it there, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned kind of, when we're talking about the brain, you talked about the amyloid plaque, and I, because a lot of people, they are at the perception, you know, when you deal with things like brain disorders, dementia, Alzheimer's, that, you know, the amyloid plaque are the reason. Is that your feeling as well, or what do you feel the function of the amyloid plaque is in the brain?
Well, the amyloid may just be a symptom. I mean, as it stands, they're saying it's the amyloid that's causing the problem, but what's causing the buildup of the amyloid, you know? And that's, I think, the further question, because it is a metabolic issue at the end of the day. That's why they call, I think they'd be called Alzheimer's, like type 3 diabetes or something. But like, there's a metabolic disturbance that's at play there. And as I said, it's a breakdown generally or superficially of a normal detox or circulatory system that's supposed to happen in the brain. And maybe it's also with the autophagy, you know, story that I mentioned. It's a lot of different elements. And so somebody who has some level of chronic inflammation in the brain, intermixed with complex genetics, usually in the cases of Alzheimer's, can be more prone to those types of disorders, degenerative disorders over time. It's like Lyme, for example, If left untreated, it creates different levels of proverbial degeneration. It's sort of a slow burn in the body, usually. Sometimes it can be really, really fiery in the beginning or whatever, but folks with a lot of chronic stuff, it's sort of a slow, arduous, you know, slugfest with it. And if it's left untreated, it'll degenerate different levels of the body. Maybe the joints of the connective tissue, and cases of the brain, it may be stuff like amyloid or you know, dementia, or early, you know, cognitive decline issues and stuff like that. So I think that it's, by the time somebody's manifesting illness like that, it's not as easy as just treating Lyme, though, understandably. So by the time somebody gets an Alzheimer's diagnosis or something crazy complicated like ALS or something like that, So unfortunately, I'd hate to say it, but like some of the damage has been done already by the lime and those types of things. And now you have to kind of like, you may still need to mitigate it and deal with it peripherally, but now you're dealing with a slightly different character and different beast. And that's a really important concept to understand in these illnesses, is what was and what is. And what started it all may be the lime, but what is right now may be something a little bit different that may require a different set of therapies and a different philosophy altogether. And that's even what I said about the, you know, say CCI or neck cervical issues. Like, I started with lime or something, okay. But if I just throw a whole bunch of antimicrobials at you, do you think I'm magically going to fix your neck? It's like, I don't think it's that simple. I wish it was. I really do.
And that's why we start to kind of classify. I mean, so you have the Lyme disease, and then you have the post, you know, where, you know, yes, you get rid of the microbial presentation, you know, so that the immune system feel under control. But then the damage, you know, like the house, you know, that was on fire. Yes, we get rid of the fire, but, you know, the house is still damaged after the fire. So now we got to repair. And we got to, you know, we got to get to work, you know, and we still may be symptomatic exactly as if we had Lyme, but in reality, it's not the microbes anymore. It's, you know, the dysfunction and the damage that's taken place.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, that's why I love the regenerative medicine world in a lot of ways. I think you could think of them just sort of as proverbial anti-aging or, you know, whatever type people. But no, it's like they have, you know, that world has a lot of value to these types of discussions, too, that if somebody's been chronically ill for a long time, how can you use, you know, different types of therapeutics to try to, you know, pull people back from further, you know, in this case, degeneration or degenerative states. It is theoretically, it could be possible. At the very least, you can improve function in an individual. You can improve quality of life in an individual. And I've seen a lot of power in that. I mean, we've used various different therapies like peptides and exosomes and, you know, stem cells. We've been using this IV PRP thing that's kind of, you know, a little bit newer, the Trudose, for example. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can sort of use regenerative medicine with immune modulation almost, and sort of mix them together. And it's pretty exciting. And there's a lot of other neuroplasticity treatments that are out there now. So I love that world. And I think that it's about timing, you know, when's it a time to think of this more like an infection? When is it time to think of it more as a complex multisystemic disorder? And when do you have to think of it more as like, we need to repair and regenerate and, you know, kind of work on the fallout, you know, the smoke damage issues that have occurred from the inflammation.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I mean, Dr. Kunkel, I mean, it sounds, I mean, you're doing a great job. I mean, it's amazing, yeah, because it is such a complex disorder, and to be able to navigate the patient through that, you know, because patients feel so hopeless, and they feel, I mean, they, like you mentioned, frequently when they come to you, they've gone to so many doctors that have looked under the normal stone. So then they need somebody that is able to kind of pull up other, you know, weapons and diagnostic tests and analyze more strategically. How can people reach you? I mean, how can they learn more about you, and you know, where should they go?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can find me on the usual channels. I believe you can even find me on YouTube if you want to listen to more of my talks. Otherwise, you could find me at the gordonmedical.com, gordonmedical.com. That's our clinic website, but there's a lot of links to a lot of stuff that we've all done, and not just myself, the other doctors, practitioners there have a lot of really cool stuff to say on these different subjects, and we all, I think, complement each other quite well, but we all have a slightly different perspective, and it's really complementary. So, yeah, you can find us easily in the digital world. And, if you're interested in, becoming a patient with us ever, just go to the website. Once again, we have a process there too. And, yeah, it's been a pleasure, but, definitely you can find me out there in the media world for sure.
Right. Well, Jamie, thank you so much. It's been wonderful. I really appreciate your wisdom and what you do for the world. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not designed to diagnose or treat any disease. I hope this podcast impacted you as it did me. Please subscribe so that you can be notified when new episodes are released. There are some excellent shows coming up that you do not want to miss. If you're enjoying these podcasts, please take a moment to write a review, and please don't keep this information to yourself. Share them with your family and friends. You never know what piece of information that will transform their lives. For past episodes and powerful information on how to conquer Lyme, go to integrativelymesolutions.com and an additional powerful resource, limestream.com. For Lyme support and group discussions, join Lyme Conquerors mentoring Lyme Warriors on Facebook. If you'd like to know more about the cutting-edge integrative Lyme therapies my center offers, please visit thecarlfeldcenter.com. Thank you for spending this time with us, and I hope to see you at our next episode of Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Carlfeldt.